There's always a danger in trying to situate a historical thinker within contemporary philosophical debates. The danger lies in distorting the thinker's views and showing that they answer to contemporary concerns. Nietzsche's thought seems to be particularly susceptible to such distortions. Over the past century, interpreters have made Nietzsche into everything from a proponent of National Socialism to a forerunner of Sartrean existentialism. In Anglo-American philosophy, interpretations have only proliferated, whereas Alexander Naumov presents an aestheticist Nietzsche whose project can be linked readily to the work of Richard Rorty. Brian Leiter has given us a naturalist Nietzsche whose philosophy sits comfortably in a movement spearheaded by the likes of Daniel Dennett. Given the diversity of Nietzsche interpretations, one wonders if we are progressing toward a more accurate picture of Nietzsche's thought or simply creating a series of Nietzsches that change with philosophical fashion. My own view is that Leiter has done some of both. On the one hand, his naturalist reading has rightly brought Nietzsche's interest in the natural sciences, an aspect largely absent from Naumov's reading, to the forefront of Anglo-American scholarship. On the other hand, Leiter consciously endeavors to present a Nietzsche that speaks to us. This not only means approaching Nietzsche with the tools and terminology offered by contemporary analytic philosophy, but also developing interpretive strategies that do, and here's a quote, that Nietzsche, the philosopher, a favor, a principle of charity. By expunging from his corpus supposedly, and this is also Leiter's colorful language, crackpot views that fail to meet the standards of contemporary philosophy. For this reason, it can be argued that Leiter is pursuing what is known in discussions about the history of philosophy as a rational reconstruction of Nietzsche's thought, one that primarily seeks to maximize the favorable evaluation of historical thinkers' ideas by contemporary philosophers with an eye to useful application, rather than maximizing historical accuracy in the representation. Although rational reconstructions of Nietzsche can serve an important purpose, they may simply multiply the number of Nietzsches on offer, as a new Nietzsche seems to be generated with each shift in contemporary philosophy. Even more concerning is that they may sacrifice what Daniel Garber calls a proper historical understanding for what we assume to be philosophical truth. It's for these reasons that I developed in my book, so I've kind of got a book out in 2014, Reading Nietzsche Through the Ancients, a historical reconstruction of Nietzsche's thought. That is, I try to interpret Nietzsche through the lens of Nietzsche's historical context and endeavor to present a Nietzsche that Nietzsche himself would understand. In so doing, I attribute ontological and epistemological views to Nietzsche that might appear weak, silly, or even crackpot, and here's the emphasis, to some contemporary philosophers, even though I do not attribute any views to Nietzsche that I think are weak or silly when judged in their historical context. So one more paragraph on this, and then I'll get to the ontic structural realism. My historical reconstruction of Nietzsche's thought has, however, been criticized for precisely this reason. In a recent view, Jessica Berry and Jennifer Daigle have objected to my work for attributing a series of views to Nietzsche that they deem to be, in quotes, nothing short of alarming. Among the allegedly alarming claims are, and these are kind of ideas that I'll talk about in the paper, one is Nietzsche is committed to an ontology of dynamic relations that rejects common sense objects as falsification of this kind of true reality. Two, Nietzsche believes that this relational ontology resists perfect or adequate linguistic and logical representation. And three, Nietzsche rejects the view that a priori reasoning of the sort Parmenides employs can be used to impact the structure of nature. To respond to such criticisms, I could recite and expand upon the textual evidence supporting my view and insist that a proper historical reconstruction will indeed force us to attribute views to Nietzsche that some may find alarming. It is, after all, Nietzsche. However, I suspect that whatever textual evidence I present to bolster my case will be blocked by those looking to do Nietzsche a favor with the kind of ad hoc interpretive strategies I identify and critique in my book, so long as such views are deemed alarming. So rather than insisting on the fidelity of my historical reconstruction to Nietzsche's texts, what I want to do here is show that my historical reconstruction can indeed speak the language of contemporary philosophy. So here's the transition. In what follows, I argue first that the relational ontology Berry and Daigle find so alarming is actually a proto-version of what is now known in the philosophy of science as ontic structural realism. As I explain below, OSR, broadly construed, rejects the existence of things in themselves and inflates the ontological significance of relations vis-a-vis their relata. And I think Nietzsche's relational ontology, one he inherits from the natural sciences of his day, does just this. Second, I argue that Nietzsche's other alarming claim that such an ontology resists adequate linguistic and logical representation actually forms the basis for an interesting response, the often level charged, one that Nietzsche traces back to Parmenides' objection to Heraclitus' philosophy that the holism implicit in OSR, or OSR itself, is incoherent. It is interesting because Nietzsche actually agrees with the charge. It is incoherent. However, he responds to the charge by claiming that if our best descriptions of empirical reality support an ontology that conflicts with a priori reasoning, then this is grounds to reject a priori reasoning as a guide to understanding the world, not our best descriptions of reality. To make my case, I begin with a general introduction to OSR and how it emerged from its Kantian variant, epistemic structural realism, or ESR. I then argue that Nietzsche endorses a relational ontology he originally finds in the work of Heraclitus, and then justifies by appealing to the results of the natural sciences of his day. Because this scientifically justified relational ontology rejects things in themselves and inflates the ontological significance of relations, I argue that Nietzsche can be understood as endorsing a proto-form of OSR. In the penultimate section, I unpack Nietzsche's response to what I call the Parmenidean challenge to OSR, and I conclude with some remarks both about why Nietzsche should be understood as a forerunner to OSR and about why a historical reconstruction of Nietzsche's thought might best serve both historical and philosophical truth. So here's just kind of an overview of what I understand to be ontic structural realism. Ontic structural realism is a relatively new position in the philosophy of science, and it challenges some deeply held intuitions in contemporary metaphysics. Among the leading proponents of this view are James Ladyman and Don Ross, and their recent book, Everything Must Go, Metaphysics Naturalized, offers a powerful statement of the position. Ontic structural realism is a species of structural realism. Thought to be the most defensible form of scientific realism, structural realism, and I'm quoting here from Chakravarti, the view that insofar as scientific theories offer approximately true descriptions of things in the world, they do not tell us about the underlying nature of reality, that is, about the qualitative natures of things underlying observable phenomena. Rather, they tell us about the structures of things. Structural realism, however, remains ambiguous about the status of unobservable entities posited by a given theory, and this has given rise to two broad forms of structural realism, epistemic structural realism and ontic structural realism. As a form of structural realism, ESR holds that science can give us knowledge of structures. However, it also holds that we must suspend judgment about the nature of the unobservable entities that generate such structures. There are different versions of ESR, but common to each is a commitment to the existence of unknowable objects and properties upon which structures supervene. Thus, a crude statement of ESR is, and this is from Ladyman, all we know is the structure of the relations between things and not things themselves. John Worrell was the first to defend ESR. Worrell's structuralism was motivated by a desire to deal with a challenge to realist understandings of science, known as the pessimistic meta-induction. Given the failures of past theories, we ought to be skeptical about the epistemic success of contemporary theories, while at the same time avoiding the no miracles argument. It would be a miracle if scientific theories were not tracking something real. That challenges anti-realist conceptions of science. On the one hand, ESR responds to the pessimistic meta-induction by noting that even though our understanding of the intrinsic nature of things has changed radically, there has nevertheless been continuity in our knowledge of the structures through theory change. On the other hand, ESR meets the challenge of the no miracles argument as a realist conception of science. Structures are real, and so science can be said to track the truth. In the scholarly literature, ESR is often associated with Kant's philosophy. And this is kind of something I'll latch on to as we go when talking about Nietzsche and OSR. The reason for the association is both theoretical and historical. It is theoretical because ESR posits a distinction between a knowable realm of structures or relations and an unknowable realm of unobservable entities or things in themselves. In other words, ESR endorses an appearance reality distinction that parallels Kant's distinction between phenomenal and noumenal realms. So I think. The association is historical because Worrell claims to identify the position in the work of Henri Poincaré. And Poincaré was, in turn, influenced by Kant. As Bakalich and Bakalich have noted, Poincaré's Kantianism is nicely expressed in the preface to his Science and Hypothesis. Quote, "The aim of science is not things themselves, as the dogmatists in their simplicity imagine, but the relations between things. Outside of those relations, there is no reality knowable. In contrast to ESR, OSR is often said to lack any historical precedent. Indeed, some see OSR as emerging from a subtle ambiguity in Worrell's paper. Although Worrell argues that structure is all we can know, as ESR claims, he remains ambiguous about the status of unknowable things themselves. Do we know that there are things in themselves that we cannot know? Or should we be agnostic or even doubtful about the existence of unknowable things in themselves? OSR resolves the ambiguity by simply rejecting things in themselves. In its initial formulation, OSR is presented as the view that there are no things, I'm quoting again from Lademan, and that structure is all there is. Since then, two subspecies of OSR have emerged in the literature, eliminative and non-eliminative OSR. Whereas eliminative OSR, defended most prominently by Stephen French, I think, from my reading, rejects the existence of things or relata that stand in relations, non-eliminative OSR holds that there are relata that stand in relations, but, as a form of OSR, nevertheless denies that these relata are things in themselves. On this view, relations and relata are ontologically equivalent. That's from Esfeld and Lamb. To encompass the very different forms of OSR that have merged, OSR can therefore be broadly defined as, quote, any form of structural realism based on an ontological or metaphysical thesis that again inflates the ontological priority of structure and relations. Interestingly, recent work on Kant has also been used first to explain the argument for ESR and second to explain how both subspecies of OSR emerge as a response to ESR. According to Michael Esfeld and Vincent Lamb, the master argument for ESR's insistence on the existence of unknowable things in themselves can be found in Ray Langton's Kantian Humility. A modified version of the argument reads as follows. I hope this works. I modified it myself. First of all, there are relations. Second premise, relations require relata, objects that stand in relations. Premise three, objects that stand in relations must be something in themselves, endowed with some intrinsic properties over and above the relations that they bear to one another. And so, therefore, there must be things in themselves or objects endowed with some intrinsic properties over and above the relations they bear to one another. The idea would be is that if you accept all three, you accept the conclusion that there must be things in themselves. OSR rejects the soundness of the argument, and this is interesting, by denying the truth of either the second or third premises or both. Whereas eliminative OSR goes after the second premise by denying that relations require relata, non-eliminative OSR accepts the second premise but rejects the third. I think that's a really neat way of understanding it, thereby allowing for relata that are nevertheless not things in themselves. In rejecting the soundness of the master argument for ESR, proponents of OSR are therefore free to reject the unknowable things in themselves that ESR presupposes, assuming there's not another master argument out there. According to Esfeld and Lamb, there are three reasons proponents of OSR have for rejecting things in themselves and so ESR. First, ESR creates a gap between what we can know epistemology and what there is ontology. Second, OSR's rejection of things in themselves heals the divide that ESR creates. You could apply that just as well to Kant. Second, proponents of OSR claim that things in themselves should be rejected for reasons of parsimony. Because relations cannot be reduced to intrinsic properties, they are necessary features of any theory. In contrast, unknowable things in themselves do not play a necessarily role in our theories. Thus, Occam's razor encourages us to look for ways to eliminate unknowable things in themselves from our theories in a way that we cannot with relations. Finally, philosophers of science have appealed to the results of contemporary quantum theory, and particularly quantum entanglement, to attack the idea that relations must supervene on the intrinsic natures of independently existing things. The appeal to quantum entanglement to support OSR is of particular importance here because I argue that Nietzsche's relational ontology is based on his claim that the fundamental stuffs of the ontology he inherits from the natural science of his day, namely forces, are necessarily entangled. I'll import that language and hopefully I'm not kind of misconstruing what Nietzsche is trying to argue. And the entanglement of forces forms the basis for his commitment to a proto-version of OSR. As Lamb and Esfeld have argued, Quantum entanglement undermines the principle of separability essential to classical physics in particular, and atomism more generally. Atomism, as the contrary of holism, is the view that the world consists of independently existing objects with some intrinsic properties, and quantum entanglement denies that well-defined states supervene on the intrinsic properties of each quantum object taken individually. Instead, a well-defined state occurs only in those cases in which two or more quantum objects stand in relation to each other, and so quantum entanglement licenses a form of structuralism or holism, which denies that the relations constituting the whole supervene on independently existing parts. A number of philosophers, such as Esfeld and Maudlin, have also appealed to quantum entanglement to challenge a tradition of atomism that dates back to at least Aristotle and finds its most prominent contemporary expression in David Lewis's Humean Supervenience. I think Nietzsche's also going after Aristotle pretty hard. Humean supervenience is the view that, quote, all there is to the world is a vast mosaic of local matters of particular facts, just one little thing and then another. Central to the position is the idea that these local matters of fact are constituted by, quote, perfectly natural intrinsic properties which need nothing bigger than a point at which to be instantiated. According to Lewis, everything else supervenes on these intrinsic properties. The problem with Lewis's position is that it is inspired by a mix of a priori intuitions and classical physics, and both of these have since been challenged by the results of quantum mechanics. Ladyman and Ross, however, argue that the intuitions Lewis employs are not unique to his philosophical project. Instead, they inform much of contemporary philosophy, and the reliance on such intuitions has created a system of shared presuppositions that, in turn, quote, has been transformed into a foundational metaphysics of individuals and a combinatorial and compositional conception of reality. The OSR that Ladyman and Ross defend challenges these presuppositions, and they present much of contemporary metaphysics as a neo-scholasticism that fails to take the methods and results of the natural sciences seriously. Even though many contemporary philosophers declare their allegiance to some nebulous form of naturalism, Ladyman and Ross claim that they often fail to understand the way in which, quote from Wolpert, the title of his book, unnatural nature of science cuts against the aforementioned intuitions and common sense more generally. According to Ladyman and Ross, science gives us reason to reject this common sense picture of the world and instead support an OSR that forces us to revise radically the way we think about reality and even the way we do philosophy. The widespread employment of common sense intuitions that Ladyman and Ross identify also runs through recent Anglo-American Nietzsche scholarship. Even though much has been made of Nietzsche's naturalism, this is kind of the dominant way of looking at Nietzsche, I argued in my book that Maud Mary Clark, one of the key interpreters enlisted in reading Nietzsche as a naturalist, significantly underestimates the way in which Nietzsche appeals to the natural sciences to claim that most of our metaphysical and common sense beliefs are not adequate to reality. What she wants to do is Nietzsche just to cut off the metaphysics and kind of preserve the common sense world with a nice continuum into the scientific. Similarly, Barry and Daigle have appealed to common sense intuitions and shared assumptions to reject the alternative reading of Nietzsche I propose in the book. Although those wedded to common sense beliefs in neo-scholastic philosophy may find proclamations to the effect that everything must go, although I understand that Ladyman and Ross don't really hold that everything must go, alarming, proponents of naturalism who are comfortable with the lessons of modern science should find themselves at least willing to consider such views and in turn be open to understanding Nietzsche as a forerunner of OSR. What I'm really trying to do is dislodge the objection that the views I attribute to Nietzsche are so ludicrous that Nietzsche couldn't actually be saying them. So here's Nietzsche's ontic structural realism, ? And that's a lot of the stuff that I have here is the kind of, I'm presupposing that you don't have a lot of background to Nietzsche, and so I can point to those kind of passages. Given the range of Nietzsche interpretations on offers, it may be surprising that Nietzsche could be cast as an ontic structural realist. Indeed, my efforts here may have me accused of creating just another fashionable Nietzsche. However, such a reading begins to make sense once one sees the way in which the interpretation I offer in my book moves between the truth relativist reading of Nietzsche presented by the likes of Naumas and the naturalist reading that Leiter has defended. In the spirit of Naumas, I argue that Nietzsche endorses a form of relativism. Against Naumas, however, I argue that he endorses, I guess, what you can call a relativism of fact or an ontological relativism or relationalism that Nietzsche nevertheless takes to be objectively true. It really is the case that relations go all the way down. In the spirit of Leiter, I argue that this relational ontology follows from Nietzsche's naturalism in at least two respects. First, Nietzsche's relational ontology eliminates transcendent or metaphysical entities in the form of things in themselves. Second, Nietzsche appeals to the results of the natural sciences to justify his commitment to this ontology. Admittedly, my own emphasis on Nietzsche's relational ontology emerged largely through a careful study of the first third of Plato's Theaetetus. I turned to the Theaetetus not so much because Nietzsche was directly influenced by the text, although we do know that he was familiar with all the Platonic dialogues and lectured on them, but because I found Nietzsche endorsing both a notion of Heracleitean becoming in his later works and a perspectivism that could be traced back to Protagoras' Homer Mensura doctrine. So you've got an ontology and some kind of relativism. And the question I faced was whether or in what way these views are compatible. And so I turned to the Heracleitean Protagorean position that Plato critically analyzes in the Theaetetus with this question in mind. The conclusion I reached was that these two doctrines are not only compatible, but even bound together by a simple teaching. This might be too neat, but what I argue is that there's a relativity principle which states that nothing exists in and for itself, but everything exists and is what it is only in relation to something else. I think it's the key teaching that Plato's attacking in that dialogue. Because I wanted to stress the Heracleitean ontology I took to be central to Nietzsche's project, but received little or no explicit discussion in the work of Naamos, Clark, and Leiter, I presented my approach to Nietzsche as a continuation of the interpretation of John Richardson and Christoph Cox, both of whom make Heracleitean becoming a centerpiece of their readings. However, my eventual emphasis on Heraclitus's relational ontology rather than Heracleitean becoming places my reading just as much in contact with the interpretation Peter Polner offers in Nietzsche and Metaphysics. Even though he lacks any explicit discussion of Nietzsche's relationship to Heraclitus, he has, through a reading of Nietzsche's late Nachlass or unpublished notebooks, placed the relational ontology at the center of Nietzsche's project. And so here I'm going to kind of read a paragraph that runs through these. As Polner's work makes clear, the Nachlass provides plenty of evidence that attests to Nietzsche's commitment to a relational ontology. In an off-sided fragment, Nietzsche claims that a thing is, quote, that first one, a sum of its effects. So it's nothing more than a sum of its effects united by a concept and image. In another fragment, Nietzsche claims that the properties of a thing are its effects on other things. And so if one removes other things, then a thing has no properties. Therefore, there is no thing without other things, and so there are no things in themselves. Because independently existing things are inventions owing to the requirements of logic, I'll get back to that last part of the paper, if everything we project onto reality to make it intelligible were eliminated, no things remain but only dynamic quanta in relation of tension to all other dynamic quanta. Their essence lies in their relation to all their quanta, in their effect upon the same. Thus, for Nietzsche, the world is essentially a world of relationships. Maybe I left that last part out. As I see it, these remarks provide substantive, if not sufficient, evidence to attribute to Nietzsche a holism that forms the basis for OSR, even though he seems to vacillate between the eliminative and non-eliminative strands. However, such a reading suffers from three potential shortcomings. First, the view has to be pieced together from Nietzsche's unpublished notes, and readers such as Clark, Leiter, and Barry have been eager to discount the use of the Nachlass. So some people say you can't go to this book, it's kind of put together in the will to power. You no longer use that. Second, the relational ontology Nietzsche articulates in the Nachlass is bound up with the view that Leiter hopes to expunge from Nietzsche's corpus, namely the cosmological formulation of the will to power. That's Nietzsche's crackpot metaphysics. Finally, the late Nachlass does not give us a good sense of the reasons Nietzsche has for endorsing a relational ontology. Instead, it seems that Nietzsche himself is engaged in a priori speculation about fundamental reality. Where did you get these claims about the nature of reality? It is here, however, that the connection between the relational ontology found in the late Nachlass and the understanding of Heraclitus Nietzsche first articulates in his 1873 unpublished work, Philosophy and the Tragic Age of the Greeks, can help address these concerns. If you're interested in the kind of fundamental kind of core of Nietzsche's thinking on my view, you go to this unpublished book, Philosophy and the Tragic Age of the Greeks. First, the relational ontology Nietzsche attributes to Heraclitus is divorced from any notion of the will to power. Second, Nietzsche eventually turns to the natural sciences of his day to justify what comes to be his own commitment to a Heracleitean ontology and to re-articulate this ontology in the scientific language of force. Finally, Nietzsche's early interest in Heraclitus's relational ontology reveals the way in which it informs many of the claims Nietzsche puts forth in the subsequent published works. In Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, Nietzsche credits Heraclitus with repudiating both the appearance-reality distinction that emerged in the thought of Anaximander and the concept of being more generally. Becoming is what Nietzsche's Heraclitus sees, and becoming entails the rejection of both metaphysical things in themselves and common sense things. Although it is initially difficult to understand why becoming, a thesis about change, especially if you say everything changes, well, isn't there a thing built into that notion, should entail the rejection of things, some clarity begins to emerge once we see that Nietzsche grounds Heraclitean becoming in an even more fundamental principle, namely the unity of opposites. For Nietzsche, Heraclitus's doctrine of the unity of opposites states that reality at the fundamental level is composed of opposites that exist only insofar as they stand in relation to each other. In other words, Nietzsche's Heraclitus thinks that reality at the fundamental level is entangled. So I'm reading this idea of the unity of opposites as a claim about entanglement way back in Heraclitus. I know that conflicts with some contemporary understandings of what the unity of opposites is about. And this entanglement explains why change is a necessary feature of nature. To develop these points, Nietzsche follows Schopenhauer in arguing that everything in space and time, as well as space and time themselves, has only relative existence. From this, Nietzsche argues that we can move on to the Heraclitean conclusion that the nature of reality, Wirklichkeit, this does work out well in the German, is nothing other than its manifestations or effects, its Wirken. Because the being of the material world lies in its activity, it is necessary for these beings continually to affect or be affected by each other. Change or becoming is therefore an essential feature of reality because the fundamental constituents of reality must be manifesting themselves at all times, and they can only manifest themselves in relation to other entities. In other words, I think Heraclitean becoming is a form of actualism, and this actualism goes hand in hand with this relational ontology. To not to act is not to exist. Although Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks provides substantive reasons for linking the relational ontology found in Nietzsche's later Nachlass to his early interpretation of Heraclitus, the work itself provides only indirect evidence that Nietzsche endorses the views he attributes to Heraclitus. However, we know from other texts from this time that Nietzsche turns to the results of the natural sciences to justify a commitment to this Heraclitean ontology. Most notably, in an unpublished lectures from the early 1870s, printed in a book now called The Pre-Platonic Philosophers, Nietzsche appeals to the work of Hermann von Helmholtz and Karl Ernst von Baer to argue that the natural sciences of his day prove the Heraclitean view, and this is number four, the Heraclitean view that all things flow. That's their main proposition. As Nietzsche explained, nowhere does an absolute persistence exist because we come in the final analysis to forces. In my book, I argue that Nietzsche's early reflections on pre-Socratic philosophy are significant because they provide a bridge to understanding his reflections on first and last things in his first book, his book published in 1878, Human All Too Human. There, Nietzsche embraces, more so than in any other work, the ethos and the results of scientific investigation to reject both metaphysical and common sense descriptions of reality. He begins by referring to, and this is really, this is hard to convince people of, but it's the problem of opposites. He says this is the fundamental problem of philosophy. He repeats it twice, also at the beginning of Beyond Good and Evil, if you're familiar with that. And he said it's the same problem that animated philosophy some 2,000 years ago is now animating us again. And he identifies two types of philosophy that emerge depending on how one answers this problem. On the one hand, there's the metaphysical philosophers who strictly divide opposites and they demand separability. And they eventually claim that a phenomenon emerged from the realm of things in themselves. So you have things in themselves, and if you have phenomena, then you derive it from the thing in itself. Historical philosophy, which Nietzsche claims cannot be separated from the natural sciences, so he aligns the natural sciences with this, denies that opposites can strictly be separated. Thus, I would say he's endorsing a form of entanglement right here, and so rejects the existence of things in themselves. What's clear is that he's wanting to get rid of things in themselves. Having made such a distinction, Nietzsche then endorses historical philosophy and promises to offer in the subsequent chapters of the work what he calls a chemistry of moral, religious, and aesthetic conceptions and sensations. So basically, he then systematically unpacks a critique of all those things, having rejected kind of a metaphysical reality in the very first aphorism. Although not explicit, there are four reasons why Nietzsche's historical philosophy can be understood as an endorsement of Heraclitean ontology and so an attempt to show how the natural sciences support such a view. First, the historical philosopher's denial of absolute opposites resembles Nietzsche's understanding of Heraclitus' uni of opposite doctrine from the philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks. This is just the problem that he places at the center between Heraclitus and Parmenides. Second, Schopenhauer also refers to a historical philosophy that he contrasts with metaphysical speculation and associates with a doctrine of constant becoming. Third, we know that in Nietzsche's had an 1888 reworking of this aphorism where he explicitly associates historical philosophy with a radical conception of Heraclitean becoming that does away with the concept of being. And finally, Nietzsche then stakes out this very position in the very next aphorisms, which I don't have quoted here. Whereas the opening aphorism of human all too human make it clear that Nietzsche wants to reject any sort of transcendent entities, further aphorisms in the opening chapter suggest an even more radical denial than accountable things or objects whatsoever. Here's the big deal. He's denying the idea that unity applies to reality, that there's objects that are called unities. Intimations of this position can be found in Nietzsche's claim that nothing in reality corresponds to the logical notion of identity. Even though Nietzsche seems to be a little confused to be speaking of two qualitatively identical things, sameness of properties, and then diachronic self-identity or numerical sameness over time. An aphorism entitled Appearance and the Thing in Itself, Nietzsche further claims that science may gradually enable us to realize that the thing in itself is empty of significance, and so, this is a great Nietzsche line, worthy of Homeric laughter. Nietzsche completes the attack on the existence of things in the section called Number. There he tells us that the laws of numbers are erroneous. They do not correspond to anything in reality. They do not correspond to reality because numbers presuppose the existence of identical things. The problem, however, is that there are no identical things. This is because Nietzsche claims there is no thing. According to Nietzsche, things are fabricated, unities which do not exist. Nietzsche then justifies this claim by appealing to the results of the natural sciences. Just as it is wrong to believe that there are common sense things, it is wrong to believe in the theory of atoms. Although we feel compelled to assume the existence of a thing or a material substratum which is moved, the whole procedure of science has pursued the task of resolving everything thing-like or material into motions. Now, at this point, one might wonder, what is Nietzsche talking about? Well, here's a guess. Nietzsche is appealing here to science to reject the things that populate the common sense and scientific pictures of the world. Although by no means clear, Nietzsche's reference to the developments of the natural sciences in this aphorism seems to have Friedrich Albert Lange's History of Materialism in mind. Nietzsche's engagement with the text is complex, but we can reasonably turn to the story Lange tells about the developments of the natural sciences in the chapter Force and Matter from the 1873 edition to help elucidate Nietzsche's remarks in Human All Too Human. There, Lange explains how modern materialism, which he casts as a revival of Democritean atomism, has slowly resolved matter into force ever since Newton introduced force into the mechanistic picture. In Lange's own words, and here I think I'm on 7a, the progress of the sciences has led us more and more to put force in place of matter, and that the increasing exactness of research more and more resolves matter into force. From Nietzsche's perspective, the developments of modern science that Lange describes can be understood as the Greek Enlightenment in reverse. Whereas modern science left behind Aristotle for Democritus, earlier modern science did that, modern science is now progressing from a Democritean worldview of matter and motion to a Heraclitean world of just motion or force. Interestingly, Lange resists the conclusion that reality is one of interrelated forces only. There's also another figure named Africon Spur that resists this as well, that Nietzsche was reading at the time. Instead, he insists first that just as properties belong to substances and predicates belong to subjects, our mind requires us to think force in relation to matter. Second, he claims that we can nevertheless only know forces through their effects and so their relations to other things. Matter, in contrast, remains completely unknown. Thus, the neo-Kantian Lange endorses what I think is a proto-version of ESR. With the advance of science, we become ever more certain in our knowledge of the relation of things and ever more uncertain as to the subject of these relations. In contrast to Lange, Nietzsche responds to this proto-version of ESR by simply jettisoning the unknown subject of these relations, namely matter, what he thinks is the final remnant of being in the scientific picture. In so doing, he endorses a relational ontology of force that I think is a proto-version of OSR. Nietzsche does this by appealing to the authority of the Jesuit mathematician and physicist Roger Boscovich, one of the figures Lange mentions in his chapter on matter and force in the 1873 edition of his work, and who Nietzsche discovered via Gustav Fechner as early as 1873. In an 1882 letter to his friend, this is kind of getting now into the more mature Nietzsche, Heinrich Koselitz, Nietzsche writes, "If anything has been well refuted, it is the prejudice of matter, and indeed not by an idealist, but by a mathematician, by Boscovich. He and Copernicus are the two greatest opponents of appearances to the eye. Since him, there is no longer any matter, except as a popular simplification. He has thought the atomistic theory through to its end. Gravity is most certainly not a property of matter, simply because there is no matter. Gravity is, like vis inertia, certainly a matter, certainly an appearance of force, simply because there is nothing else other than force." Although the view that Nietzsche attributes to Boscovich is probably closer to the view of matter later espoused by Michael Faraday than by Boscovich himself, the letter is significant for at least two reasons. First, Nietzsche explicitly associates Boscovich with Copernicus. This suggests that Nietzsche's opposition to appearances to the eye is not an opposition to empirical evidence as such. Instead, he is claiming that Boscovich follows a Copernican tradition of appealing to refined scientific observation to reject untutored observations and common sense beliefs. Second, even though Nietzsche appeals to Boscovich to reject matter, he nevertheless remains a realist about force. Indeed, Nietzsche claims that there is nothing other than force. The letter is also significant because the dual reference to Boscovich and Copernicus directly parallels Nietzsche's remarks about Boscovich and Beyond Good and Evil. In the 12th aphorism, so now we're into kind of Nietzsche's main works, Nietzsche again refers to both Boscovich and Copernicus's opposition to visual evidence, and he appeals to Boscovich's work to argue that, quote, materialistic atomism is one of the best refuted theories there are. According to Nietzsche, Boscovich has shown us that, quote, nothing stands fast, and so we must abandon our belief in substance, in matter, in the earth residuum, and particle atom. Having rejected atomism in the physical realm, Nietzsche then goes on to critique the atomistic need in the psychic realm by rejecting what he calls soul atomism. Thus, Nietzsche appeals to Boscovich to reject atomism in all its forms. And just as he suggests replacing an atomist conception of the soul with a structuralist one, there's a lot of interesting work being done on this, Nietzsche's drive psychology right now. That is, he calls it a social structure of drives and effects. His rejection of atomism in the physical realm implies a commitment to the structuralist ontology he originally attributes to Heraclitus. Although the relationality of force is only implicit in Nietzsche's appeal to Boscovich's rejection of atomism, we can gather further evidence for such a view by such an understanding of force by both turning to Nietzsche's sources and by considering its relationship to the will to power. So the claim will be here is that forces are necessarily relational, and Nietzsche's working in the context in which Nietzsche is working, that we can kind of show that. On the one hand, Mattia Riccardi has traced Nietzsche's understanding of force back to Kant's definition of force as respectus or relation, so it can be tied back to Kant, and then through the work of Afrikanspor and another individual, Otto Kaspari, to argue that forces are necessarily relational and so not substance-like or things in themselves. On the other hand, we know that Nietzsche designs the cosmological formulation of the will to power to complete the victorious concept of force in the physics of his day by ascribing an inner quality or will to it. I'll get to this in a bit. Since Polner and Riccardi have both argued that the doctrine of the will to power is itself a relational ontology, one in which there are only dynamic quanta, whose essence lies in their relation to all other quanta, the forces that form the basis for the doctrine of the will to power must also be relational. Because the attempt to complete the concept of force that Nietzsche inherits from the natural sciences with the will to power complicates my argument, I want to conclude this section by stating why I understand Nietzsche to be defending a proto-form of OSR, and by explaining why the introduction of the will to power does not threaten my claim. So here's the idea. I've mapped out what OSR is, and now I'm going to say I mapped out what I think Nietzsche's kind of ontology is, and I'm going to try to put the two together. To begin, Nietzsche's a realist. I'll just kind of go right down the line. because he believes in a mind independent world best characterized in terms of relational forces. Second, he is a scientific realist because he thinks that entities, the entity science describes, namely forces, are real. Third, he offers a protoform, this is the one that I think most about, of structural realism because he thinks that these forces are relational, and he thus believes that science does not tell us about the underlying nature of reality or the qualitative nature of things underlying observable phenomena. So I'm going back to Chakravarti's understanding or definition. Finally, he's an ontic structural realist. I've just kind of marched right down the line. Because the relational ontology of force he endorses is, quote, based on an ontological or metaphysical thesis that inflates the ontological priority of structure of relations. Although four of those are true, if we can march right down the line, then I've done it. Indeed, it seems that Nietzsche feels the need to complete the concept of force. And here's the interesting thing. The concept of force, Schopenhauer repeatedly calls it an occult quality. And Nietzsche seems to want to complete it with the will to power precisely because he thinks the natural sciences fail to tell us about the qualitative nature of things underlying observable phenomena. And this failure creates an explanatory gap, so forces don't explain, that must be filled if Nietzsche is to complete what Schopenhauer calls naturalism proper or a system of pure physics. So to complete the naturalist program, you got to give me an explanatory principle that is itself natural. In this way, Nietzsche seems to both endorse a proto-form of OSR in terms of what he thinks we can get from science, but nevertheless agrees with the criticism that structuralism undermines the explanatory power of science. But rather than abandoning OSR for this reason, Nietzsche sees it as grounds for going beyond what the natural sciences describe by self-consciously using introspection to interpret forces as wills to powers. He's going to do what Schopenhauer does, and does the inward move, and he's going to consciously ascribe an inner quality, almost turning forces into maybe like active powers. In so doing, he will have an explanatory principle that allows him to explain otherwise unfamiliar phenomena in terms of something absolutely familiar. This is the other reason why he turns inward. He thinks that if you go with science, you run from the familiar to the unfamiliar. For explanation to happen, you have to flip that around. Nevertheless, because such an interpretation of reality both preserves and depends upon the relational ontology science describes and so avoids a return to Kantian things themselves, Nietzsche's claim that the world is a world of power, nothing besides, does not threaten his status as a forerunner of OSR. So world of power is more than what he gets from science, but nevertheless that kind of basic structure is there. The Parmenian challenge to OSR and Nietzsche's response. A minority view in the philosophy of science, as a minority view, OSR is not without its critics. Indeed, criticism of OSR not only occurs in contemporary debates in the philosophy of science, but also in Nietzsche scholarship. In this section, I discuss what I will provocatively call the Parmenidean challenge or charge that OSR is incoherent. This claim is provocative in two senses. First, it depends on Nietzsche's reading of the relationship between Heraclitus and Parmenides, in which Heraclitus is presenting as a founding father of a kind of holism that supports OSR, and Parmenides is presented as rejecting holism on the a priori grounds of incoherence. Second, I contend that criticism of OSR in the philosophy of science and Nietzsche's relational ontology and recent scholarship can be understood as variants of Parmenides' challenge. As noted above, OSR now comes in two flavors, elimitive and non-elimitive. In various articles, Anjan Chakravarti has leveled the charge of incoherency against both by defending the truth of premises in the master argument, Kantian argument for things themselves. According to Chakravarti, elimitive OSR is false because it violates P2, the claim that relations require relata. For Chakravarti, it just seems obvious, quote, that one cannot intelligibly subscribe to the reality of relations unless one is also committed to the fact that some things related. Chakravarti's case against non-elimitive OSR is more complex, but also rests on the charge of incoherency. In defending P3, this is really an argument for intrinsic properties. You got to have them. He argues that it's impossible to liberate objects from their intrinsic properties. This is because an object without intrinsic properties must be wholly constituted by extrinsic properties. However, an extrinsic property is, and I'm quoting here, one that is possessed by an object in virtue of its relation to other things. Thus, an object constituted exclusively by extrinsic properties makes no sense of what it is that stands in relation to other things. And so if you provide an analysis of the object in terms of extrinsic properties alone, we face circularity or regress. Chakravarti therefore holds that we must either accept intrinsic properties and so reject reject OSR or pursue the eliminative strand of OSR. Since he also rejects elsewhere the eliminative version, it seems that he rejects OSR altogether. Interestingly, a similar objection can also be found in the secondary literature on Nietzsche. Having demonstrated Nietzsche's commitment to a relational ontology, Nietzsche's and metaphysics basically, Polner then proceeds to criticize the view for reasons strikingly similar to Chakravarti's. Specifically, Polner has been said to argue that Nietzsche's relational metaphysics collapses into incoherence due to its dismissal of intrinsic properties. According to Serena Doyle, I think is who is Polner's student, her analysis of the argument, Polner is committed to two theses. One, relational properties cannot be intrinsic properties, one or the other. And two, relational properties must be grounded in something intrinsic. Because Nietzsche claims that all properties are relational and relational properties cannot be intrinsic, according to Polner, Nietzsche's relational falls into incoherence because it violates the claims that relational properties must be grounded in something intrinsic. Doyle, interestingly, has appealed to the work of George Molnar to try to escape the incoherency charge by challenging Polner's first claim. Specifically, she argues that for Nietzsche, quanta of force have intrinsic properties insofar as they exist and are what they are independently of their manifestations that are nevertheless relational. She wants to collapse relational and intrinsicality. I don't know if she can do that, but she's kind of saying, well, insofar as they're independent of their manifestations, they have certain intrinsic features, but they necessarily manifest themselves in relation to other things and so are relational. However, such a reading seems to transform Nietzsche's wills to power into substance-like entities that can, as pure potentialities, exist independently of their relations to other entities. For this and other reasons, I think Nietzsche offers a different response. To begin to see why, it is important to note that Nietzsche actually agrees with Polner that a relational ontology that rejects the existence of things endowed with intrinsic properties is conceptually incoherent. So he's going to say, you're right. This is evidenced by the fact that in his initial articulation of the position, Nietzsche not only acknowledges that Heraclitus' Union of Opposites doctrine violates in some way Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction, he also interprets Parmenides rejecting Heraclitus' relational ontology precisely because it is incoherent. So Parmenides raises this objection. Nevertheless, Nietzsche defends in the same work Heraclitus against the attacks of Parmenides and Aristotle. However, he does not do so by arguing that Heraclitus' views are in fact coherent. Instead, Nietzsche simply challenges a suppressed assumption that underlies the charge of incoherency. This underlying assumption is what I will call, in the spirit of Nietzsche's critique, Parmenides' prejudice. And we can identify this assumption by looking at how Parmenides rejects both Heraclitus' philosophy and generates his own understanding of reality. On the one hand, Parmenides employs the logical principle of non-contradiction to reject the holism that Heraclitus derives from careful observation of the sensible world. So it becomes a regulative principle. On the other hand, Nietzsche's Parmenides appeals to the logical principle of identity to develop an atomistic conception of being that is completely divorced from the relational properties that the senses reveal. In both instances, Parmenides' prejudice is that he assumes that the world necessarily conforms to the way we think. And so he assumes that we can employ a priori analysis both to make claims about the nature of the world and to place restrictions on what we can endorse in our empirical theories. Thus, if there's a conflict between empirical observation and a priori analysis, Nietzsche's Parmenides thinks the former should be sacrificed to the latter. So in cases of conflict, get rid of empirical observation. In contrast, Nietzsche simply argues that if our best description of empirical reality conflicts with a priori analysis, we should simply reject the assumption that there is a neat conformity between our thinking and the world. Although Nietzsche's defense of Heraclitus will certainly alarm some, I agree that this is somewhat alarming. I think we can ease such concerns by briefly looking at Tim Laudlin's response to Einstein's objections to quantum entanglement. Specifically, Maudlin explains how Einstein resisted the idea of quantum entanglement because non-separability threatened the intelligibility of the world. As Einstein writes to Born, if we do not assume the independence of, and I'm quoting here, the existence, the being thus of objects which are far apart from one another in space, which stems in the first place from everyday thinking, physical thinking in the familiar sense would not be possible. As Maudlin rightly notes, Einstein is effectively placing an a priori demand on what a physical theory must endorse, in this case separability, in order for it to be comprehensible. And so Einstein is trying to infer an ontology, the structure of the world, from the demands of epistemology, the structure of our minds. Maudlin offers two responses to what I think is Einstein's version of the Parmenidean challenge. First, Maudlin claims that because quantum theory has both abolished separability and developed a rigorously tested theory, it seems possible to adjust our concepts in the way that Doyle tries to do for Nietzsche, so as to avoid the charge that quantum entanglement is unintelligible. At the same time, Maudlin challenges, in very Nietzschean fashion, the very idea that our conceptual frameworks can be used as a guide to developing a proper ontology. Because science provides us with reasons for believing that, quote, extravagant accounts of what exists might be correct, we should begin to think of our systems of representations not as guides to ontology, but rather as, quote, as impediments to understanding the world. In particular, Maudlin points to Aristotle's mistaken belief in the categories that there is a parallelism between grammar and ontology, such that we can read off the structure of the world from the structure of language. In contrast, Maudlin follows Russell in claiming that, quote, we commonly interpret features of a representation as features of the thing represented, thereby illegitimately projecting the structure of our language onto the world. As I see it, Nietzsche couldn't agree more. Indeed, Nietzsche simply extends Maudlin's critique of our tendency to project illegitimately the structures of language onto reality to our tendency to project illegitimately the basic rules of logic onto reality. And so Nietzsche moves from the claim that the structures of language and logical thinking make it difficult to understand reality to the claim that the structures of language and logic makes it impossible to understand reality with perfect adequacy. Similar to Chakravarti and Polner, Nietzsche believes that a priori thinking forces us to posit the existence of things in themselves or the little id of logicians, even though we never encounter things in themselves in sensible reality. It's our minds that are constantly forcing us into believing in things in themselves. In contrast, Nietzsche simply rejects the idea that the empirical world must conform to our intellects and so rejects the idea that there must be things in themselves. To assume that there is an isomorphism between thinking and being, or what the scholastics would call an adequatio intellectus ad rem, is to fall prey to the all-too-human tendency to anthropomorphize the world and to assume uncritically that we are designed to know the world and the world is designed to be known by us. He thinks there's a God lurking in the background of that assumption. Of course, even proponents of OSR might find such a response rather discomforting. Whereas OSR seeks to eliminate a kind of skepticism caused by ESR's gap between epistemology and ontology, the holism of OSR that Nietzsche endorses now seems to produce an alternative form of skepticism due to a discord between ontology and epistemology. In response, it should be noted that the post-Kantian choice Nietzsche identifies is not between skepticism of knowledge of things in themselves. Instead, is between two versions of skepticism, and Nietzsche chooses the skepticism generated by a relational ontology because it eliminates a transcendent realm of unknowable things in themselves that Kant and Schopenhauer used to ground an ethical program that Nietzsche, quite frankly, wants to destroy. So if eliminating the metaphysical world comes at a price of having to endorse a form of skepticism, then Nietzsche is willing to pay the price. Whether this is a price the contemporary defenders of OSR will also be willing to pay or even forced to pay is, however, certainly open to question.